Support for WVIK comes from Kathleen Collins at the Dragonfly in Bettendorf. Using both conventional and alternative counseling methods for empowerment to help create change for individuals and couples. More information is at KathleenCollinsCounseling.com.
Hi, everybody, and welcome back to the Heartland Politics Show and podcast, which is aired on and distributed by WVIK Quad Cities NPR. WVIK is the flagship public radio station in the Quad Cities region of northwestern Illinois and eastern Iowa. I'm your host, Robin Johnson, and, you know, for those of us that are a little grayer and older, we remember a time when our government used to do big things, the interstate highway system, although that was a little bit before my time, the space program was when I was a child. It just seems like we don't get to experience that anymore. And I really think this is part of the reason that explains Donald Trump's popularity as a businessman, and president, as somebody who at least is perceived as getting big things done. There's a very, very timely book that's been written about this topic, and the author is my guest today, and I'm very pleased to have him. The book is called Why Nothing Works, Who Killed Progress and How to Bring It Back, and the author is Mark Dunkelman. Mark, thank you so much for taking the time to be on today.
Thrilled to be here. Thanks for having me.
I love how you start the book off with going back to our founders and two antagonists in our federal system right from the beginning. And I use these two founders in my political science classes to show that we're still kind of debating the same basic arguments. But start there and talk about the different philosophies they have and how that's kind of, at least at the beginning, impacted our country and our ability to get things done.
Yeah, so right from the beginning, right from the colonial period, the debate among the patriots was about who should get to decide big things. And there were sort of two big fears that were the primary narratives in their debate. On one side, there were people who were afraid of chaos. They were afraid that, you know, the French Revolution wasn't too long after the American Revolution. And you could have this sense that without a powerful centralized government that could make big decisions, nothing would ever get done, and that we would be subject to all sorts of tragedies of the common, meaning that, you know, if everyone let their livestock feed on the same public area at will, then soon enough there'd be nothing for anyone to eat. So you needed to have some sort of system for ensuring that people only sent their livestock out for X number of hours each day, and that there was some enforcement, right? You needed some centralized institution to do that. And the fear of chaos was that absent someone having that power, everything would sort of fall apart. That was Alexander Hamilton. That was his fear. And much as he reviled the English king, he believed that in order for America to be, and this is his quote, for America to be a Hercules in the cradle, there would need to be some strong centralized institutions that could be both public and private. There would be government, there would be financiers, but the whole point was we needed people to have a lot of centralized power so that they could make sure that the country grew. On the other end was Thomas Jefferson, and his fear was exactly the opposite. His fear was that centralized institutions were going to be too powerful, and that the financiers in New York and Philadelphia were going to use the power that they wielded through the purse to sort of overcome and overwhelm the interests of ordinary yeoman farmers who were property owners throughout the country. And so his view was that we needed to really put guardrails around centralized institutions so they couldn't wreak havoc. And the argument in my book is that that sort of core debate, both ideas in the hearts of every mind the hearts and minds of every American, has resonated throughout American history. And that in the sort of the bulk of the 20th century, from the late 1800s to like the 1960s and 1970s, that Hamiltonian notion really prevailed for the most part. People were eager to see big things being done. When the Great Depression hit, they looked to centralized government to take care of them. That's certainly true in the agricultural world through the AAA and through subsequent subsidies and whatnot. They looked to big government to, for example, build the Tennessee Valley Authority, which was a huge institution that had almost untrammeled power to take land, build dams, wire up poor farms, reforest certain areas, reimagine the Upper South entirely, sort of in the mind of one character who ran the TVA named David Lilienthal. And that then in the 60s and 70s, Jeffersonianism found its level. That we saw all the ways that the old Hamiltonian establishment had done bad. They'd thrown DDT on our crops that caused birth defects. They'd allowed cars to be come off the assembly line unsafe at any speed, as Ralph Nader said. They sent us into Vietnam, which turned out to be a quagmire. They eventually got us involved in Watergate. And during that period, the notion was that the old establishment that Americans had really vested a lot of authority and faith in during the bulk of the 20th century was fundamentally corrupt. And so that almost in every venue, we needed to speak truth to power. And that meant a legislative agenda that said little people have been given short shrift. The yeoman farmers of old are now the working class and the poor, and they've been trampled in almost every facet of their lives, whether it's the interstate highways or urban renewal or housing or energy, you name it. Little people didn't have enough say, and we were going to create processes that would make sure that their interests were honored. And so that became my argument in the book is that for the last 50, 60 years, that mentality, that zeitgeist, that desire to put guardrails around powerful institutions has become so omnipresent in our lives, so overwhelming that now, whereas it used to be too easy for a bad project to get off the ground, now it's impossible for a good one to get started.
I liked too how you mentioned right out of the gate in your book Robert Moses, the subject of Robert Carroll's what I forgot how many pages. I finally read that book, and it's outstanding. But that was kind of the examples in that book of the Hamiltonian excesses really came through, and that's kind of where you start your book.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there is an element, and I'm sort of proud of having said this in a subsequent interview. You know, the 1968 convention we all remember as this battle of sort of the big old establishment inside the hall, and then these sort of hairy anti-establishment counterculture hippies, the Chicago Seven, marching outside. And one, the insiders were really Hamiltonian for the most part, and the outsiders were really Jeffersonian, right? The insiders wanted to let the war keep going, and they had views of just let the power brokers broker power. And the outsiders, those on the outside, were convinced that the establishment was fundamentally corrupt. That's 1968. The power broker comes out in 1974. And Robert Caro, who writes The Power Broker and wins the Pulitzer Prize, exposing Robert Moses, who was the establishment figure in New York City from the 30s to the 60s, and exposes just the damage that he's done to working class communities and to poor communities, and that he has, in sort of this imperious way, ignored the interests of local leaders and even the mayor and the governor and the president, and imposed his view on this landscape of New York City. That he is, in sense, the sort of very erudite academic, he is Abbie Hoffman in a tweed jacket. That he's taken he's taken what those protesters were doing outside the 1968 convention and sort of not laundered it exactly, but made it palatable to the establishment, to made it palatable to those of us who are listening to NPR or sort of in the world of thoughts and ideas, that it's not just some sort of, you know, teenage, young 20s people being sort of going through their adolescence and punching out at authority, that authority really was bad and that it needed to be curtailed. And it so the power broker is sort of right there at the vanguard of this intellectual change, particularly within progressivism, whereas progressives had once wanted to sic government on big problems and have government fix it for them. They now were very dubious of whether government itself wasn't bad. And that's a big shift, particularly on the political left.
I want to give a couple of examples here. They deal mostly with infrastructure, but you go into detail in several of your chapters and on issues that really need attention right now. Housing, one of the big issues we have is a lack of supply of housing, I think is fair to say in many places. How does this emphasis on process hold back building more a bigger supply of housing, for example?
Well, everybody knows that there isn't enough housing because if you've tried to buy a home or you're trying to rent, you know that the costs are way above what anyone can reasonably afford or what it's recommended that you afford. And we've tried for, decades to ameliorate those high costs with subsidies, demand side subsidies. So make it easier for you to put down that first payment on your mortgage, or we can give you a voucher to cover some of your rent or whatever it is. That's been the focus, particularly on the left. And people are realizing that that's not sufficient, that the pr housing prices have gone up and up. And the housing market is a market, right? In the sense that like the price that you have to pay is what the market will demand. And if there is not enough housing, the prices are going to go up and up and up. And so what we've discovered over the course of the past several decades is that everybody now basically believes that there needs to be more housing, but that nobody wants it to be built near them. And so the question is, when someone proposes, a developer or someone else proposes a new big set of multifamily homes in a neighborhood, should it be built? And looking from 10,000 feet or looking at the whole city or the region, almost everybody says yes, but the people who live right nearby say no. We don't have the facilities. The kid, if more kids move in, there won't be enough seats in the elementary school. We don't have enough electricity load to cover that. We can't. The sewage system wasn't built for that many people. There'll be too much traffic on the roads, et cetera, et cetera. They find all sorts of reasons that housing shouldn't be built in that particular place. They're for housing generally, but they're against that particular project. And that's become known in sort of the world of wonks as NIMBYism, not in my backyard. And the thing about NIMBYism is it's not new. No one has ever wanted a change. If they like their neighborhood, whether it's poor or rich, they often don't want it to change in the sense that if you're in a rich neighborhood, you don't want poor people moving in. And if you're in a poor neighborhood, you don't want rich people moving in and raising rents. So everybody sort of up and down the income scale is generally against more housing. And what we've done over the course of the last 50 or 60 years is create all sorts of statutes and excuses so that people who don't want housing near them have tools they can use to stop it. They can say that it's going to have an environmental impact. They can say that there's a historic building that's going to be impacted. They can say there's an endangered species that's going to be involved. They can say that it's a disparate impact, that if you're going to build in this neighborhood, you should first have to build in that neighborhood because there are racial disparities between the neighborhood. There are just an innumerable number of tools that people can use to stop a housing program that they don't like. In some cases, those are legitimate concerns. In some cases, it's just that people are trying to protect the character of their own neighborhood, are not willing to accept the costs locally that come with trying to ameliorate the housing shortage regionally or nationally. And the truth is that we need to find some balance. It shouldn't be that somebody like Robert Moses can come and throw a multifamily unit up in your neighborhood without you being able to say boo. But by the same token, it shouldn't be that anyone who has any objection to any housing project is able to stop it through the threat of litigation or actual litigation. And so we need to come to some sort of balance where everybody has a voice, but not everyone has a veto.
You're listening to Heartland Politics on WVIK, Quad Cities NPR. I'm your host, Robin Johnson, and my guest today is author Mark Dunkelman, who's written a very important book, I think, that most people can relate to, because there's examples of this in both Iowa and Illinois in our region. But it's called Why Nothing Works, Who Killed Progress and How to Bring It Back. Mark is a fellow at Brown University's Watson Institute for International and Public Affairs. He worked more than a decade in politics, working for Democrats in both the U.S. House and Senate. And he also served as a senior fellow in the Clinton Foundation. I bring your political background up because this is a issue that hurts the Democrats more. I mean, because they're the party of government. And it seems like this was kind of a self-inflicted wound that the party did to itself back. And you describe it as a culture. If you could talk about that a little bit more.
Yeah, I mean, when you look back at the old progressives of the Wilson, Roosevelt, Johnson era, so that's sort of the bulk of the 20th century, the story that they tell the public and that they themselves believe is that the problem throughout the country, our big problems, are only solvable if we put experts in charge and have those experts fix the problem. We need experts to arm the country so that we're prepared for the First World War and the Second World War. We need experts to build the highway system. We need experts to send us to the moon. We need experts to build dams. And we need experts to... It's all about taking science and rational thinking and imposing it on the chaos of American life. And certainly, when you look at what the private sector did by itself before the Great Depression, like... Or what was happening overseas during the Second World War, like, that narrative resonated with ordinary people, certainly with working class people. The private sector had left them to fend for themselves during the Great Depression. It was only when Roosevelt came in and used government institutions and centralized power that they were given some reprieve. And it was only through the exercise of raw military power through the government that we were able to save ourselves from the specter of fascism and then of communism. And then after the 50s and 60s, when we turn that on its head, when we begin to say, actually, the solution that we've been imposing for the last several decades is itself the scourge, which is a strange thing to say. I mean, I just noting for listeners, right? It was Ronald Reagan who said that the 8 most frightening words in the English language are, I'm from the government, I'm here to help. But even before Ronald Reagan, it was Democrats, it was progressives who were marching outside the 1968 convention and part of the counterculture, and that the underlying message of all of that sort of Sturm und Drang on the left was that government is itself bad, that it is Jim Crow, that it is the highway engineer planning to take over your farm, that it's the highway engineer that's going to, or the housing specialist who's going to claim a whole block and take an old, you know, a working class neighborhood and render it to rubble. Like, that's a big shift in thinking. But the downstream effect of having that intellectual shift, that cultural shift, is that rather than saying, as previous Democrats and progressives had done, how can government fix this problem, the question that progressives began to answer was, how do we stop government from oppressing its own people? And, like, I don't want to make it sound as though government is always good or that government was right, blameless during this long period where progressives were pushing for more of it. But I do want to argue that now we're at a point where we're so convinced that government is going to do the wrong thing, that we've imposed so much process that we have guaranteed it to fail. It's not too big to fail. It's guaranteed to fail. That government, you will elect a Democrat to, for example, build electric vehicle chargers in the places where electric vehicle chargers aren't, so that people don't buy electric vehicles because they're afraid that when they're on a long drive, they won't be able to find a place to charge their car. And when the government gets $7.5 billion, as the Biden administration got at the beginning of the, when the infrastructure bill passed 3 years before he left office, the thought was that thousands of these EVs would be up in short order, and suddenly it'd be very easy to buy a car that was electrically charged, and you wouldn't have to worry when you're driving to grandma's house that you would be stuck in the middle of nowhere. But when the time came and it was time for President Biden to leave office, the government had only built 58 chargers. And that wasn't because anyone was incompetent inside the government. It wasn't by malefactors of the evil people who were trying just to take their paychecks and not do any work. Like, everyone was working hard at this, but it's really hard to do when there aren't federal workers, as there were under the Tennessee Valley Authority, to do this. When you have either no, there's no federal office that knows how to do it, that they have to give the money to the state departments of transportation and the state highway departments. They don't know how to build EV chargers. And there are all these federal laws about how you do contracting. So they're trying to contract to the right people and figure out that, make sure that they only build these EV chargers that are subsidized in places where the market wouldn't bear it itself. And then finally, once you've figured all of that out, you have to convince these utilities to actually wire up the EV chargers, and they've got all sorts of demands from private customers who are going to be much higher paying, so they're not eager to do it quickly. So the point is here, we've basically ensured that government can't accomplish things on its own because we're afraid of the harm that government used to do. But now we've got a situation where everyone knows that government is incompetent. They're frustrated by it. And when you see that you're not getting served by the government you elected, your temptation is to vote for someone who will just knock it all down. And that's what Donald Trump's appeal was. It's been his appeal for his entire public life. It's what he did in New York City in the 1980s. And the reason I think that, you know, there's a phrase that was popular for a few years during his first term, that the cruelty is the point. I'm not sure that's right. I think that the cruelty is a symbol, sort of a, even maybe a signal, that he is as rough and tumble as it needs to be when it comes to just shaking apart an incompetent bureaucracy. And, you know, you can react to that by calling him a racist and all the things that he is. But you could also say there's a certain kernel of truth in his complaint, and people feel it. They see that the government is not delivering housing, that it's not building new, better transit options, that it's not attacking the climate crisis, that it's not getting us access to clean energy. In all sorts of realms, the notion is the government is the DMV on its worst day. And in a situation like that, it's not hard to understand why people are choosing the party that's against government rather than the one that's for it.
I thought it was interesting because I go back to Barack Obama's comment when we passed economic recovery legislation about the topic of shovel-ready projects, which was kind of a new term at the time. And he didn't realize that there weren't as many or any at the time. And that, you know, when you're in the midst of the worst economic downturn since the Great Depression, timing is important. It's important to get shovels in the ground, get projects going. And I think of that, and I think of the major legislation Biden passed, the CHIPS Act, Inflation Reduction Act, and then the infrastructure bill, which just, it seems like things didn't get done quick enough where he or Vice President Harris could take credit or advantage of that enough.
I think that's right. I mean, you would have hoped that they could have done, you know, flown around the country cutting ribbons for the last year of their presidency. I mean, it had been 2 years. They should be, you know, at least shovels in the ground or whatnot, but it wasn't. And that's in such stark contrast to when you hear about the New Deal and you hear what Harry Hopkins did, like standing up whole bureaucracies. There were, and then employing millions of people within weeks or months of doing it, and yeah, figuring out how to get this money out fast. And you know, I live in Providence, Rhode Island, and when I take my dog for a walk, I frequently go through a park that was built by the Civil Works Administration, I think, or one of those in the alphabet soup of programs that were in the New Deal, and how immediate the feeling was in the public that what was happening in Washington was actually changing the physical landscape that they inhabited. The Biden administration came and went, and certainly a lot has gotten done. And if you talk to Mitch Landrieu, he'll tell you about the number of projects that were funded, and et cetera, et cetera. And I think he's right about that. But the common experience today is not that was a radical transformation of the American landscape. And government needs to be re-empowered to do big things because we've got some big challenges ahead of us.
Absolutely. I mean, the electric grid, you go into that in your book, in one of the chapters there, and it's like we're getting more and more demand for electricity for AI, and I'm all electric in my house, but yet our grid is just in decrepit shape, and we need to upgrade it. And you went into the book very well about how that is not going to be easy to do under the current processes as well.
Yeah, I mean, I have just a crazy story about an effort by a Republican governor in Massachusetts to buy clean hydroelectric power from Quebec to replace the equivalent of 700,000, pollutant-emitting cars on the road each year. Like that's how much pollution he could have taken out of the atmosphere. And the problem is that Massachusetts doesn't abut Quebec. And so he has to build a transmission line through one of the adjacent states. And he eventually settles on Maine after New Hampshire turns him down. And it's been 10 years almost now. And like that process is still ongoing. So the dirty, polluting generation plants that are around New England are still in operation. And we're not taking advantage of this clean power. And, if we're going to get more power online and it's going to be clean power, we need the ability to weigh the costs and benefits of building a new transmission line through a forest, even if that means endangering some species of orchid. It's to get 700,000, carbon emitting vehicles off the road. It is worth it to give up this orchid species. Now there are going to be hard trade-offs in the future, and we need a system that will allow us to balance those concerns. But like in the end, it can't be that everything is so hard that nothing gets done.
Mark, I've got time for just one more quick question. I'm sorry about this. I got about 30 seconds, but you say in your book, you don't really focus on specific solutions, but is there an example of a state or another country that's doing a better job at balancing these interests that you can point us to?
Well, there are lots of examples, and I'll be quick. It's California just passed a bill that'll make it easier to build housing, infill housing, without having to go through a lot of environmental reviews. And you look at Spain, they do a much better job building transit than we do, and have figured out a way to make it much cheaper, so that New York is an outlier and very, very expensive, but everywhere in the U.S. could be getting transit for a much better deal for taxpayers.
Well, it's an outstanding book, and it's been lumped together with the Ezra Klein book on abundance. But I think your book stands on its own in a sense, and that I really like the historical foundation. You talk about an articles, a confederation moment here, which I really love that phrasing. But for my listeners, it's another excellent book. I think it's very well timed, and it's called Why Nothing Works, Who Killed Progress, and How to Bring It Back. Mark Dunkelman, the author, has been my guest today. Mark, thank you so much for taking the time.
Thanks for having me.
You've been listening to Heartland Politics with Robin Johnson, a presentation of WVIK, Quad Cities, NPR. You can follow Heartland Politics at WVIK.org or wherever you subscribe to podcasts.